baseball fans, and welcome to the Prospects Podcast here today. I'm your host, Chris Mitchell, and we've got a fantastic guest on the agenda today. Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline is going to be coming on today. Lots to talk about when it comes to minor leaguers right around this time. The All-Star Game's coming, and obviously we're talking a lot about the selection process and the players and in the first half of the Major League Baseball season. But for me, and I think Jim might agree, he's a big reason why this Futures game even exists altogether. I mentioned this on the podcast the other day. But to me, the best part of All-Star Weekend is, A, the conversations that surround the game itself. Who made it? Who didn't make it? The snubs. But also the players who've really had fantastic first half of the season. But the game itself, yes, the All-Star game is nice. It's a nice little ceremony. But the Futures game is really, to me, is exciting. Seeing all these young players, seeing the stuff and the nasty ability of some of these players, to me, that's the highlight of the weekend. And no one's going to convince me otherwise. And even if you're not a prospect person, to me, that's the game that you really want to see. Those are the players that really excite me. And we don't get to see them as much. Unfortunately, minor league prospects have grown a lot. And like I said before, and I talked about this on the podcast before, I think Jim Callis went back and when he started doing prospects, it's such an industry has grown so much, and Jim has done so much good work in this field that I think he's a significant reason why it's grown to the popularity that it has. But we still don't see enough games. You can apply to watch on TV on MILB.com and things like that, and that's a nice thing. But I don't think a lot of people get to see in person or even on television the prospects that we're going to get to see in this Futures game. So this weekend's really a fantastic time, and that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk a little bit about some players, players in focus. We'll talk about Julio Urias. We'll also talk about Lucas Giolito and Tyler Glasnow. It's a quick little primer about their current situations and to get an outlook on what Jim thinks they're going to do here in the major leagues and how the Dodgers are handling Urias. Then we'll get right to it. We'll talk about the Futures game. We'll also talk about the 2006 amateur draft if we have time. We're going to put in about 30 minutes of prospect talk here. No commercials, no breaks, just Chris Mitchell, your host, and Jim Callis, the honored guest here today. Let me bring Jim into the program. Jim, we love having you on the podcast. You've come on multiple times. We appreciate you taking the time. And thanks a lot again for coming on here today. And how's everything going with you and the family?
Going good, Chris. You know me. I appreciate all the kind words, and I'm always willing to talk prospects and draft. So, I look forward to Futures game. By far, the highlight for me for All-Star Game weekend, and especially this year because on Monday I'll be flying across the country from San Diego to Charlotte. So I'll be in town for the AAA All-Star Game, which is Wednesday, if I have my calendar correct.
And again, I talked about how I really do believe you played a big role in how popular prospects have become. But is there really even a time where you're not swamped? I mean, between international signings and the amateur draft and the different All-Star games and when prospects can be traded at the major league deadline in the off season when free agents are signed and trades happen, prospects are always brought up. And then is it really a time of year, even Christmas, where prospect talk isn't a pretty busy time? You must be swamped now with the way the industry has grown.
Yeah, I mean, it is busy. I don't do international stuff too much, so that, I don't know how I would squeeze that in, but I have kind of bounced from months on the draft to still reporting the last few signings to jumping to the College World Series last week, and now I'm off to the Futures game, the AAA All-Star game, and I'll do some probably more over the phone than travel, but some Team USA and Cape Cod League stuff to get ready for next year's draft. And we're revamping all of our top 30 prospect lists right before the trade deadline, and we'll move guys around as they get traded too. But I would say that once the trade deadline comes by, like starting in August through maybe about early November when we start gearing up and doing draft stuff, like it's not as busy. That's probably my slowest part of the year. The off season winds up being busy the second half of the off season because we do a lot of prospect rankings and that type of thing. But I'd say from August through early November is probably the time where I catch my breath a little bit.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Cape Cod League because I'm hoping to do some coverage of that for that this season. I spend a lot of time down there in Katuit, which has one of the Cape Cod League teams. So, unfortunately, I don't get to see anywhere near as many Cape Cod League games as I'd like to, but I'm hoping to do some coverage this year. It's a really nice league, and it's one of the things that doesn't get, I think, anywhere near the kind of coverage it probably deserves. It's everyone knows about it, of course, but I don't see a lot of coverage analyzing the prospect, and maybe covering high school kids that are college kids, and maybe that's asking for a bit much, or maybe that's the next industry to be expanded. But I'm hoping to see some of those games. Let's get right to it. We're talking with Jim Callis here from MLBPipeline.com. You can also follow him at JimCallisMLB over on Twitter. Let me ask you real quickly about a couple of the new prospects that are in the Major League now or coming. First, let me talk about Julio Urias. And the Dodgers are handling him in an interesting fashion. And I like to compare him to Mr. Espinosa up here in Boston, because these are two guys with elite stuff that how you manage them seems to be pretty difficult. When they're so good, you have to rein them in. It's almost like a prime stallion. You don't want to overuse them or use them before he can actually run the top races. How have you seen – what were you – I guess when I saw him in his starts, I was expecting him to be filthy, nasty, and I guess you can't help but be slightly disappointed when you do that. But every time you look at Urias' numbers, they're extremely impressive. I'm curious.
I'm with you. I mean, I kind of expected him maybe to have a lower ERA than a 4.95 and pitch a little bit better. But then you look, and he did have 44 strikeouts and 36 innings as a 19-year-old. I just think sometimes, and I think this is probably the case with him, where – especially the younger you are, I think it's more difficult. You get up to big leagues, you try to do a little too much, and maybe he overthrew a little bit because he walked, what, 8 guys in 41 innings in AAA and 17 guys in 36 innings in the big leagues, and the command wasn't as fine and the control wasn't either. But, he's a difficult one to handle because, he was pitching in the Midwest League at age 16, low class A, and I can't remember the last guy who did that. And he dominated, and they kept him to about 55 innings. And then he dominated in high class A at age 17, and he pitched 88 innings. And last year they had him do a elective eye surgery during the season to keep his innings down, and he only pitched 80 innings. But he got to double A, spent most of the year in double A at age 18, and even made 2 starts at the end of the year in triple A. And so I would think, Chris, that they probably, because he's only 19, he'll turn 20 in August, they probably won't ramp him up over 120 innings this year, maybe 130 tops. And he's already at 77. I think they kept him in the big leagues a little longer than they initially hoped, because they had some injuries. And I understand. I mean, this isn't a Strasburg situation, because this guy, is very young, and you don't want to have him pitch 150, 160 innings when he only pitched 80 last year. But I would think at some point soon they'll probably put him in the bullpen. And, I mean, I've actually advocated this the last 2 years when they've been in the playoffs, is I thought they should have called him up to the big leagues in September, used him in some short relief appearances, and if he didn't seem overwhelmed, because the stuff is very, very good, obviously, used him in the playoffs. But to me, I would probably use him as a reliever, and I bet they will pretty soon to keep his innings down and possibly toy with the idea of using him in the playoffs. I don't think it wouldn't make sense to me to have him make another 8 starts and say, okay, you're done, in mid-August. But, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what they do with him.
Do you like how they've handled it? Again, it is a difficult and a unique situation. We don't see a lot of prospects being managed this way because Urias is unique. His skill set and at such a young age is definitely a rarity. Do you like how they've done it? And how many innings do you think he'll get next year? Do they go with a 30 or 40 inning kind of bump up? Or what are you expecting for 2017?
Yeah, I do like what they've done. I mean, you do have the theory there's only so many bullets in a gun and so many innings in a guy's arm. But at the same time, I mean, if you look at baseball history, there's a lot of pitchers who were very good in their early 20s, and then they were kind of done being anywhere close to that good by the time they turned 30 because they just pitched too much. And I think the biggest parallel I think of with him is Felix Hernandez, who, the Mariners kind of faced the same dilemma. But even Felix Hernandez was not pitching in low class A at age 16. I mean, he's even kind of ahead of where Felix was, although Felix made some in-season promotions. I think they've handled it the right way. I would think if he pitches 120 or so innings this year, you'd probably limit him to 150, 160 next year. If he makes the big league club, you kind of limit him to 5 or 6 innings for starts, or maybe you shut him down for some time, or maybe you start him if you're planning on having him in the rotation at the end of the year. Maybe you start him in the bullpen and then stretch him out as the season goes on. But I do think, because like I said, I can't remember anybody who was pitching in full season ball at age 16, and he wasn't just pitching at that level. He was dominating. I think you kind of have to have this unique path with him. Similarly, if Felix Hernandez, was pitching in high class A at 18. Well, Urias was doing that at 17. You know, he jumped up to double A at the end of that season, and then he was at the big leagues at the end of his age 19-year-old season, which is kind of what they're doing with Urias. You know, now, and in Felix, they stretched out more. Felix pitched 150 innings at age 18, and he pitched 170-something at age 19 and 190 at age 20. And, you know, Urias, you know, they've kept him, I think, because he got start a little quicker, just a little bit lower. So, you know, it's tough. You know, and you mentioned Espinoza, who is a very interesting prospect also for the Red Sox, and he's very precocious too. But Anderson Espinoza is 18 years old. I mean, he's you know, about a year and a half younger than Urias, and he's only in low A. You know, again, Urias was pitching there at age 16. So he's just an extra – like I said, I don't even know who the last – you know, I don't know if anybody's even done the research. Who's the last 16-year-old to pitch a full season in full-season ball and dominate? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's definitely unique, and trying to find even close comparables is not easy. and Felix stayed healthy, so I guess the Mariners did a pretty good job. If that's the sort of the boilerplate that they're using to some degree, then that may be the one that works going forward, maybe for Espinoza as well. Let me ask you also about Lucas Giolito, and again, an elite prospect. These are kind of rare guys we're talking about here. Some of the people I talk with, they were complaining about the fact that he wasn't striking out a lot of guys, that they didn't like that his command maybe wasn't as good as they were hoping for. Again, this is based on high expectations. Giolito is a fantastic talent, don't get me wrong or anything like that, but these special guys have special expectations, probably unfair. What are your thoughts on what you saw with him when he made the major leagues, and how do you like what you're seeing this year from him, and what should we expect going forward for the remainder of 2016, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, I actually wound up missing. I didn't get to see his first start because I was out at the College World Series the day he came up. But, you know, I mean, he looked pretty good that day for four innings from what I heard. He wasn't as dominant in Double-A at the start of the season, although there's been talk that, you know, there was some change in his mechanics and he went back to pitching the way he was. Again, people need to realize this guy is 21 years old. You know, there aren't a whole lot of fully formed pitching prospects at age 21, and this is another guy who's been handled carefully because he had Tommy John surgery, hurt his elbow in his draft year. You know, pitched, you know, 36 innings in 2013, pitched 98 in 2014, 117 in 2015. I mean, the guy's pitched about 325 innings in pro ball right now, you know, and he's been in pro ball for 5 years. So he's been handled very carefully, too. I think this guy's going to be very good. I was impressed by the fact that he didn't try to blow everybody away. In his first big league start, he had to deal with rain, and you know, so it was a truncated outing, but, I mean, this guy's got, you know, fabulous stuff, and I think he's going to be, you know, his stuff's even better than Urias's, and I think he's got a little bit better control and command than Urias too.
Yeah, I rated him as my number one overall prospect going into this year, and I like Urias. There's lots of other good prospects, but to me, he's a guy who could possibly be an ace. There aren't a lot of them out there, but to me, he's one of the potential ones, and I love the breaking ball. Anyone who can throw a filthy breaking ball to me, that's what I look for, and of course, plus velocity as well. And for me, he was the number one guy overall, and I would definitely have him as the number one pitcher as well. Let me ask you about Tyler Glass now. He's getting promoted. He's going to have his first start on Thursday for the Pirates. What are you expecting from him? He's a very tall guy, a little bit of a command issues with him as well. The Pirates are in kind of a bind with some injuries here. I'm curious what you're expecting from Glass now when he gets up there, and how do you think the Pirates are going to handle him the rest of this year?
I think it depends on the health of the rest of the rotation. But, I mean, the guys who are healthy haven't pitched well, and the guys who have pitched well are hurt. And, you know, he's up now. I mean, I don't think there was a ton more. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, control and command have never been his forte, and he still needs some work on that. But, I mean, he's leading the minor leagues in strikeouts. He's got a 1.78 ERA. His opponents are hitting 176 off him. I would expect he'll come up and miss bats and probably walk a couple more guys than you like, but not get hit particularly hard. You know, 6'8", you know, it's a fastball. Even when it's in the strike zone, it's difficult to hit because it's got angle and plane and life to it, as well as good velocity. You know, when he stays on top of his curveball, it's got very, very good depth. It wouldn't surprise me if he came up and had an immediate impact like Jameson Taillon was having before he went on the disabled list.
And I talk about Alex Reyes a lot, and everyone loves him, and his stuff is extremely electric. Glasnow is right there as well. I don't know if his stuff's quite as electric as Reyes, but that's asking a lot. I mean, Reyes' arm is really something special. But right now, this year at least, Glasnow's got 52 walks in 96 innings. I believe Reyes is comparable or even worse than that. But again, people just can't hit glass now. It's just, if he throws a strike, they just can't hit it. As far as, or they can't make good contact on it, at least. With Reyes, if he throws a strike, they miss it. And if he throws a ball, then, you know, they don't swing at it. At what point do we look at a guy and say, look, their command is a problem, but they're going to stay a starter? How many walks, or what kind of percentage does it get to the point where they become a reliever rather than a starter? Because, again, 52 walks in 96 innings, that's more than half the innings they're walking somebody. That is a lot. But I've never heard that Glasnow, now that he's in AAA, I've never heard that he's going to be moved to the bullpen. What kind of numbers do we need to see in order to think that that could become a possibility?
Well, I think the biggest number to look at with him is that he's 22 years old. I mean, if he's doing this when he's 24 or 25, and you know, let's say he's, you know, struggling, you know, he's still walking a guy every other inning, you know, then I think it's tougher. But, I mean, I think what people got to look at with both those guys and, you know, is that these guys are extremely young, and you've got to give them time to develop. Again, I mean, you know, I don't think pitchers are fully formed at a super young age. I mean, the guy we were talking about today, like trying to come up with a comp for Tyler Glasnow, and Jonathan Mayo was saying, you know, he does a lot of our pirate stuff. The one he's heard the most is A.J. Burnett. And, you know, A.J. Burnett never really had fine control either. You know, it kind of ebbed and flowed. But, I mean, his last full year as a starter, he led the National League in walks. And, you know, it's kind of like there are some days where he threw a lot of strikes and he was almost unhittable. And there are other days where he got in trouble with walks. And, you know, I think that's going to kind of determine, okay, is Tyler Glasnow going to be that front of the rotation guy, or is he going to be more of a mid-rotation guy like A.J. Burnett was for much of his career?
And again, it's probably not a fair question. If you look at like an Alex Meyer with the Twins, he doesn't walk quite as many guys as Reyes or Glasnow, but he doesn't seem to be able to stick in the rotation. But his stuff probably isn't as good as theirs either. But I guess
when Alex Meyer's at his best, it is. But he, you know, for whatever reason, as good as the stuff is, he gets hit. And I don't know if it's a case where he's walked a bunch of guys in AAA. Before this year, he's barely pitched. But, you know, that was kind of what happened when he got to AAA, is his control went down. And I don't know if it's a case with him that when he starts to, you know, struggle with command a little bit, he takes something off and then he gets hit. But, you know, his command and control never really kind of got there either.
Yeah, he's a guy that I've been following. Again, maybe the physical comparison is why. And, again, the stuff is pretty good there. We're talking with Jim Callis from MLBPipeline.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at JimCallisMLB. Let's get into the amateur draft and the futures game here coming up now. Let me first ask you about the minors in general, and before we get to the actual amateur draft here. When I was looking at the preseason rankings, and I do it from more of a fantasy sports perspective, so I look at things a little bit differently. Maybe I set a higher bar for the players, so maybe I come across a little critical. But there were a lot of shortstops on list this year. I don't know if there was 30 or 40 out of the top 75 or 100, but I think it was pretty close to that. The numbers are immense at how many shortstops are viable in the minor leagues right now. I remember back when Theo Epstein drafted, for example, Jacoby Ellsbury, and it was his opinion that you wanted to be drafting more athletic guys. And that seemed to be – I mean, of course you'd love athletes, but it seemed to kind of signify a little bit of a change in priorities on the type of play you want to be drafting. Rather than just going after raw power or something like that, he seemed to be saying that he wanted athletes. How is the minor leagues compare now to maybe 3 or 4 years ago? It doesn't seem like to me the high-end prospects, or maybe there's not as many of them. I don't know if that's the case, or so many have been promoted that it's going to take a little while to restock. I don't know. What are your general thoughts on how strong or how much weaker or how different the minor leagues are right now compared to 5 or 6 or 7 years ago?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if the focus for what teams are looking for is really that different, Chris, because I think people have always looked for up-the-middle players. You know, and a lot of times you'll see shortstops. You know, big leaguers were shortstops when they first signed. So I don't know if that much has changed in that regard. I do think – I kind of feel the same way if you look – and I haven't we're going to do it soon. I haven't actually done my list, but when we're going to update our overall top 100 prospects list in midseason and kind of line the guys up, but even in the preseason, I wasn't blown away. And I just think part of that is that these last two rookie classes we had in 2014 and 15 were so deep, and last year's might have been the best rookie class of all time in terms of production. And guys like Chris Bryant Sr. or Addison Russell, just to name a couple of Cubs who were on the All-Star team, seemed to race through the minors really quickly. And I think while we were all like enjoying like all these rookies coming up the last couple of years, what the flip side of that people didn't really think about is like, well, if the guys are getting there quicker, you know, and this is like a special class, and these guys are progress through the minors, well, it's going to leave the minors a little depleted compared to that. So I don't think it's necessarily down compared to 5 or 6 years ago. But I think if we're looking at prospect lists going into the last couple of years, you know, 14 and 15, they look down because so many of these guys have gotten to the big leagues. And, you know, these types of things just seem to run cycles.
And I do remember last year being criticized for being a pretty bad draft, and yet everyone is completely enamored with Alex Bregman. And everyone criticized the Diamondbacks for trading Dansby Swanson. And if you're going to criticize last year's draft, don't rip into the fact that the Diamondbacks traded the number one pick for Shelby Miller, who's coming up a really good season, or don't just completely and totally fall in love with the fact that Alex Bregman looks really, really good and Brendan Rodgers may end up being an elite player in Colorado. It seems like maybe there's some kind of bias to it. And maybe the minor leagues are getting more athletic. I mean, if we've got that many shortstops, does that mean more athletes are playing the game than before? I remember hearing that as being a concern when everyone was playing basketball and that it seemed like baseball was maybe losing some of its athletes. But if you've got this many shortstops, you got to be a pretty good athlete to play shortstop. I could be wrong there, but that's my evaluation anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cyclical. I mean, I think baseball's still getting a number of athletes. You know, and they're always going to wish they had more. But, you know, I don't think that the minors as a whole are necessarily more athletic. I just think right now shortstops are the it position. And 5 years from now, we may be podcasting Chris, and you may be asking me, hey, where are all the shortstops? You know, where have they all gone? I think the position stuff tends to run in cycles a little bit, you know, when you talk about that stuff.
Yeah. How do you rank this year's amateur draft, the 2016 draft? How does it rank compared to last year? How does the makeup of the draft strike you differently or similarly than 2015 or even 2014?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny, I forgot to answer that part of your question before you even bring up 15. I mean, what people criticized about that draft was so many pitchers got hurt, they didn't think the talent at the top of the draft was classic top-of-the-draft type talent. But that said, if you compare 15 to 16, Dansby Swanson would have been the number one pick this year, Alex Bregman would have been the number one pick this year, Brendan Rodgers would have been the number one pick this year, I think Andrew Benintendi would have been the number one pick this year. Last year's pitchers were better than this year's pitchers. So I think 2015 draft, I don't think it's an all-time classic draft, but I think compared to 2016, all of a sudden 2015 looks a lot better. I mean, there was some talent in this draft. The difficulty with this year's draft for teams was the clear depth in this year's draft was high school pitching, and that's also the demographic that scares teams the most. Because, you know, it seems like the harder guys throw at a younger age, the more they get hurt. And so people, you know, worried about that. And, you know, for the most part, the high school pitchers still went high. But I do think if you combine 15 and 16, then you probably would have had 6 or 7 or 8 of the top 10 picks in the draft might have been from the 2015 draft. And, you know, Swanson, Bregman, Rodgers, Benintendi, I would have taken all four of those guys over anybody in this year's draft.
Yeah, I'm not in love with the offensive players in this draft. I did like some of the pitchers. I don't know if I liked Ian Anderson quite as much as the Braves did, but I like Groom, who fell to the Red Sox. I like Puck. Maybe there's some weaknesses or limitations or some blips in their overall makeup, but I like some of the pitchers in this draft. But it is interesting that this year may be weaker than last year. I don't get any sense that people felt like that coming into the draft, though.
Yeah, I think they did. I know going back when I was writing about it last fall, everybody was kind of like, this crop isn't really lining up to be real exciting. So, although, I mean, to be fair, Chris, I think people say that almost every year, except for this decade, 2011, which was a deep, really deep draft, and people knew it at the time. I just think most years people are sitting there lamenting that there isn't more talent in the draft. But, yeah, I mean, I felt like I was writing the same story I was writing last year, this year, when I kept writing, nobody's real excited about the talent at the top of the draft. There's no classic top guy up there, so... you know, we'll see. And I don't think, I'll be honest, I don't think next year's that much better either. I mean, it's not blowing me away where I'm saying, oh, you know, there's some obvious guys who are clear-cut number ones, or number one candidates, I should say.
And maybe, because I'm trying to read what I'm hearing and people talking, maybe they're just being less critical. Maybe they're evaluating the draft similarly or worse. They're just not saying it as loudly, maybe. I just remember people just totally, completely just bashing the 2015 draft as it was coming up, and I don't remember that kind of negative talk about it. Again, I'm talking fans and everything. I'm not talking about you, but
Yeah.
It's an interesting draft. I like that the Red Sox got Groom. I'm intrigued by what he can do. So maybe I'm a little bit biased by my Red Sox love out here. But let me also ask you, let's transition here to the futures game. How do you like the rosters? Let's start at the top. Which roster is better?
Well, I think the U.S. roster is always better. Not that the U.S. players are definitely better than the world players in general, but just I know from being involved with trying to put the rosters together, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if you just went down both rosters and you picked out guys that you thought were top 100 caliber prospects, the U.S. team's always going to have more than the world team because there are some positions that are hard to fill sometimes, whether it's world catcher or the depth on the world pitching staff. From experience, I can't think of a year where I didn't think the U.S. roster was deeper than the world roster.
Which roster is better at the top, the elite guys?
I'd still say the U.S. I mean, I'm looking here just off the top of my head. I mean, U.S. roster, you've got guys like Jeff Hoffman, you mentioned Alex Bregman, Dansby Swanson, Andrew Benintendi, David Dahl, Clint Frazier. You know, that's seven, and that's not just top 100 guys. Those are probably upper half top 100 guys. On the world team, you've got Alex Reyes, maybe Gary Sanchez, Jorge Mateo.
What do you think about Ronaldo Lopez? I've heard interesting reports on him. I really liked him last year. Keith Law spoke very highly of him this year. How good is he?
He's good. He's got a live arm. I think he needs a lot more polish. I mean, I wouldn't put him in the upper half of the top 100. I was going to say, you've got Moncada. There's three. So maybe you have three. And you have other guys who are going to make the top 100 there as well. And I did not mention Jorge Mateo, Chris, as we record this. I guess I don't know what it was. He violated team protocol in Tampa, so he's been suspended for 2 weeks. So we won't get Jorge Mateo in the futures game. But yeah, I just think if you line up a prospect for prospect, if you were to rank the top 20 prospects in the futures game, most years, I'd say 12, 13, 14 of those guys, the best guys would be on the U.S. team.
And if you're someone out there who doesn't follow prospects all that closely, but you are going to tune into the futures game, who are the few of the prospects that you think are really going to wow them this year?
Well, there's always a bunch. I mean, if you were just taking, the best hitter and pitcher on each club, because otherwise we could name a bunch of guys, on the U.S. club, I think you got Dansby Swanson. You actually got Vanderbilt team. Probably the two best prospects are Dansby Swanson and Carson Fulmer, who were both picked out of last year's draft out of Vanderbilt. I'm saying, if you pick hitter and pitcher, I mean, Alex Bregman also. I mean, Alex Bregman's right there, and Ben Tenney's right there. I mean, there's four guys out of last year's draft who are probably among the three position players are probably among the top, 10 or 15 prospects in the game right now. And then on the world team, you've got Alex Reyes, you've got Yoan Moncada. Those are probably the top two prospects on the world club.
How good is Yoan Moncada, and how quickly are the Red Sox going to get him to Boston, or how slowly?
He's an interesting one, too. I mean, he's very, very good. I mean, he's well above average runner, and I think plus hitter, and going to have at least average power and play decent second base. But the interesting thing is, Mookie Betts already moved off second because they had Dustin Pedroia. I don't think Pedroia's going anywhere soon. I think he's going to be ready for Boston at some point next year. I mean, you could say, well, the guy's athletic. A lot of clubs, you say, okay, let's make him a center fielder. Well, you already got Jackie Bradley, and you got Mookie Betts who can play center field too. I think, Chris, and I know you're a Red Sox fan, I think he winds up at third base. Maybe Travis Shaw goes to first base, and Haylen Ramirez goes to DH, because Andrew Benintendi is probably going to be in that Boston outfield some point next year as well. And you just to think of all the young talent on that team. But that's going to be an interesting thing is where you play him, because I don't think it's going to be second base right now.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, because it seems like you're wasting a lot of athleticism if you try to put him in left. And like you said, Benintendi can play left as well. Third base seems like the obvious place. You think he has the skills to play there?
Yeah, he does. I don't think he'll be a gold glover. I don't think he's a great defender. That's the weakest part of his game. And his arm is fine. It's not a great arm. I think you could get by a third. It's a plus arm. I mean, so he could play third. I think he'd probably be an average third baseman with a plus arm. I was tripping over my words there. But I think he's going to hit enough and run enough and have enough pop that he'll be fine there. And it's again, I mean, it's kind of optimal if you're moving guys to less challenging positions because they're going to be more athletic there. I think he probably fits better third than second. I think he's an average second baseman. And if you put Benintendi in the outfield, I mean, you got three center field caliber outfielders in left, center, and right, in Benintendi, Jackie Bradley Jr., and Mookie Betts. So Benintendi plays center for a lot of clubs, but I don't think anybody's going to push. I don't think anybody's going to push Jackie Bradley Jr. out of center field.
No, it looks like the Red Sox are sort of the Pittsburgh Pirates of the American League when it comes to that outfield, and they've got so many young players, and it doesn't seem like they want to move any of them. That's one of the speculations is, we'll trade Jackie Bradley and get a pitcher, but it doesn't seem like they want to do that.
No, I think it would be tough. I mean, if you could get an ace caliber pitcher, I mean, I guess you'd entertain that, but, like, I don't think many people are trading aces, and I wouldn't trade Jackie Bradley Jr. for a guy who you're going to plug in that toward the back of a rotation. I just don't think it would make any sense.
No, I agree with that. And I think that's what a lot of teams tried to do with the Red Sox last year, and they weren't buying. I was saying that probably 2 years ago when Jackie Bradley was hitting 187. It's like a smaller budget team should have been trying to steal him away from the Red Sox, and I don't think the Red Sox were willing to buy into that and give him away, but if I was another team, I would have at least been trying. I've said for a long time, even if he doesn't hit.
I'm with you on that, Chris. I think if he just hit 250 with a little bit of power, his defense is so good that he's still a valuable player. And I do think other teams were interested in trying to pry him from the Red Sox, but they weren't going to sell low on him. And, a lot of what Ben Cherington did toward the end didn't necessarily work out for him, but I think he deserves a lot of credit for not just parting with Jackie Bradley Jr. in a short-term panic type of move.
Yeah, I think Ben Cherington did a lot of good things. He wasn't necessarily a great major league GM as far as making trades or signing free agents. And I always wonder how much control he had there. How much was Larry Lucchino? How much was management? How much was the ownership? And how much was Cherington allowed to do? I mean, is he to blame for Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez? I'm not positive he was. But the one thing I think we know is that Theo Epstein, Cherington, Hazen now, they did really well in the minor leagues. Obviously, the Red Sox have built that organization through the minors for quite some time, going all the way back to John Lester, and now being one of the best up-and-coming young major league rosters. And the minors are loaded, too. And you can't really, quote-unquote, cheat anymore as much. You know, you don't see Andrew Miller dropping to the 20th pick because of money anywhere near as often as you used to see. Or in the international market, a lot of teams are more – it's at least more balanced. Would you agree with that? It's harder for big market teams to bully the smaller market teams now. It's still doable. But is it more difficult?
I don't know if they bullied them, because if you go back and look, I do think the teams that spent the most on the draft were more of the small revenue teams like the Royals and the Pirates. But I do think what is tough now, and it probably hurts the Red Sox more than anyone, is the Red Sox were the one big market team that was really aggressive in the draft. And I think it goes back to 2005. I remember talking to Jason McLeod, who ran the scouting department in Boston for a number of years. If you go back and you look at Boston's 2005 draft, that was a year that they had the five picks before the second round, and they all made it to the big leagues. You mentioned Ellsbury earlier. There was Craig Hansen, who didn't work out, but wound up getting traded for Jason Bay, Clay Buchholz, Jed Lowry, Michael Bowden. That was a pretty good draft. But the flip side of that was the Red Sox also drafted Pedro Alvarez, Charlie Blackman, Alan Dykstra wound up being a first-round pick. Jason Castro wound up being a first-round pick. They were on Ryan Smoke but didn't draft him because he wasn't signable. And they went back and looked. They almost signed Pedro Alvarez but didn't get it done. And there was some frustration on their part. It's like, look, we've identified the players. Why don't we go pay them and sign them if we're identifying the right guys? And if you look, in subsequent years they did that. And they were the most aggressive large revenue team by far in the draft, and now you just can't do that. If you win, you're going to be very limited in what you can spend on the draft, and that's what's happened to them. But they still found a way to go out, and they were fortunate. They were picking seventh the year. Andrew Benintendi was on the board for them. Anderson Espinosa, obviously a great signing. They spent a lot on Moncada. I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the best guys in the system right now, a lot of the best guys are international, and that's – you could still kind of go crazy internationally. You're prohibited from signing big money guys for a couple years after that, and the Red Sox just got in trouble for kind of doing some package deals to try to get some Venezuelans last year. But you could still kind of spend crazy internationally if you want, if you're willing to sit out for a couple of years. So what you have teams do is they basically go crazy 1 year and load up on what they figure is 3, 4, 5 years worth of talent, and then they'll sit out the next couple. But I do think that probably changes in the next CBA.
Yeah, I just remember going way back when the Pirates signed Daniel Moskis rather than, I believe it was Matt Wieters, and they acknowledged not too long after that they knew he was a reliever, and Matt Wieters was the maybe the prize of the draft. I think that was the two players that were happened that year where teams just couldn't sign those top guys. I remember that being quite some time ago and it being different now. But let me wrap it up here. We got to let you go. I don't want to take up all of your time. There's a lot of names on these world and on the futures rosters here, and a lot of them aren't all that well known. If you had to name a few that would surprise us, even the people who follow prospects, who are a couple guys that you think we'll see in this futures game that may say, wow, that guy looks maybe better than we realized, or I didn't even realize he was that good? I guess sleepers, I guess we'd call them. Who are the sleepers on the world and the Ross and the USA team that we should be looking at for this game?
Yeah, the US team, I don't know if there's a lot of sleepers because most of these guys, like I'm looking at the outfield, for example, and everybody in the outfield was a first or second round pick. I mean, people may not know much about Dylan Cousins, who's second in the minor leagues right now, but he's built like a defensive end, which makes sense because his dad was a defensive end who got drafted in the NFL and played in college at Pitt. So, I mean, he might be a sleeper people don't realize. There's a reliever, JT Shagwa of the Twins, who can hit 100 miles an hour. He's probably not a household name. That may open some eyes on the U.S. team. On the world team, there's a player from Lithuania. I'll probably butcher his name here, Chris. I think it's pronounced Davidas Neverauskas. He's a Pirates farmhand. He can hit 98 miles an hour. Again, he's a reliever. I don't think a lot of people are familiar with his work. And I don't know if this guy's a sleeper because he was a big money. He was the best prospect in the international market a couple years ago. But then you know, you're signing so young, and he hadn't done a whole lot in the minor leagues before this year, and he was in the Cubs system, so he gets overlooked because they had so many other prospects who are zooming to the big leagues. So I don't know if I'd really call him a sleeper, but I don't think he's on anybody's top 100 prospect list coming in the year either. But Eloy Jimenez is 19 years old. He's having a great year in low Class A, plus power, plus arm, right field profile. So again, I'm not going to call him a sleeper because if you follow prospects, you know who he is. But I didn't think people may look at this guy in a futures game and go, geez, you know, where'd the Cubs get this guy? Here's another one.
Yeah, I remember Eloy Jimenez because I've owned him in a couple of my dynasty leagues. And one of the problems with owning a guy like him is he signs at age 16. He doesn't play a lot of games for the first couple of years. And then all of a sudden he's 19 or 20. And all of a sudden he emerges as a potential star. But it's been 4 years. I mean, a lot of times we want quick results. We're greedy, those fantasy people. We want a guy to show some real signs, you know, 2, 3 years in. And these guys like Jimenez, it takes 4 or 5 because they sign him, you know, before they're even, you know, beyond puberty almost. They really do sign
him pretty young. He was signed basically 3 years ago, and he's just now getting the full season ball, but at the same time, he's only 19 years old, too. So, I mean, it's essentially like if he had signed as a high school player at age 18 last year's draft, he'd be at the same stage of his career, but you tend to forget about these guys for a little bit because it usually takes them a little while to get going, like you said.
I want to ask one last question, and this is completely out in left field, but it bothers me because I don't know the answer to it. And if I'm putting on your spot and you don't know, I think you probably do.
I'll tell you if I don't know. I'd rather make up an answer for you, but go ahead.
There are certain parks that are extremely hitter-friendly. And, of course, Coors Field in Major League Baseball is the prime, you know, gold standard craziness of the ball flying out of the park. But it distorts minor league numbers. And since we don't get to see a lot of these players and we don't know the parks or the organizations or the affiliates quite as well, the general fans, what parks in the minors – most grossly impact stats either in the benefit of pitchers or in the benefit of hitters that you should say, you know what, this guy hit 25 home runs, but he did it in the Coors Field of the minor league. What parks stand out like that? And again, I don't need all of them. Just a few
I was going to say two leagues that kind of stand out that way is the Cal League, High Class A, and Pacific Coast League and AAA are very offense-oriented. But I think the worst park in the minors is probably Lancaster, which the Red Sox – dislike so much that they bought the Salem franchise in the Carolina League so they wouldn't have to go back to Lancaster. And I remember talking, you mentioned Mike Hazen, when Mike was the farm director, I remember talking to Mike Hazen about Lancaster when they were there, And Mike told me, he said, you know, I knew, you know, I'd heard the wind will blow out like 30, 40 miles an hour at Lancaster, but until we got there and had a team there, I didn't realize it was literally every game. Colorado Springs, which plays a lot like Coors Field and, you know, used to be Colorado's AAA affiliate, which I thought kind of made sense, but is no longer. I think it's Milwaukee's affiliate now. That's a launching pad. Las Vegas is a launching pad. A lot of the PCL and a lot of the Cal League parks, it's just like they're so distorted. I hate to pick on Lancaster, but I just think it's a bad place to, you know, it's a nice park, but it's a bad place to develop talent because, you know, your hitters all put up huge numbers and your pitchers all get shellacked, and none of it really means anything. I mean, go back and look at some of the guys who put up huge years in Lancaster, and for the most part, it's a lot of guys you've never heard of.
That's what I wanted to know because I just I hear off, you know, comments on occasion about, well, that's that, but I think it's important because, again, most of us out here follow it statistically, and you see these huge numbers, and you say, oh, wow, the guy figured something out. Well, he didn't figure it out.
Well, go look at, like, for example, talking about Las Vegas. I don't mean to interrupt you, Chris, but talking about Las Vegas, go look at what Noah Syndergaard did in AAA. He had a year, he spent a full year in AAA and had a 4.6 ERA. And, you know, he gave 154 hits, 133 innings, and then there's a lot of, oh, you know, is this guy overrated? What's going on with him? Well, Las Vegas is a terrible place to pitch, and that actually wasn't a bad year for Las Vegas, and he still struck out 145 guys, 133 innings, and didn't walk a lot of guys. It's just a great place to hit, and he got burned by the park. And, you know, what happened the next year? Well, next year he's pitching the World Series for the Mets, and the year after that, his stuff's about as dominant as anybody's in baseball. So Matt Eddy at Baseball America does a good job, and he usually does it on an annual basis at the beginning of the season, kind of identifying the parks that have played extremely hitter-friendly or pitcher-friendly, and that's always a good article to read because you really have to take those numbers with a grain of salt. You know, if somebody, you know, if you're a Mets fan or a fantasy player and you're writing off Noah Syndergaard because he has a 4.60 ERA in AAA, you're making a mistake because he actually pitched pretty well there. It's just not a very fair place to pitch.
That's what I want to know. Jim Callis from MLBPipeline.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at Jim Callis MLB. Jim, I always appreciate you putting in the time tonight. Really, thank you for taking your time. We look forward to talking to you again. Enjoy the Futures game. Enjoy the AAA All-Star game. And all the best to you and your family.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I really appreciate it. Take care.
All right, that's Jim Callis from MLBPipeline.com. Again, you can always follow him on Twitter, at Jim Callis MLB. Love having Jim on the program. Does a fantastic job, obviously, as you heard here. And if you haven't been following him or you don't know the kind of work he does, he's as good as you get out there as far as prospects go. And I wasn't just kissing his ass at the beginning here. He was at Baseball America when prospects were a rarity, and he helped literally make prospects the industry as large as it is at this time, and he's been doing great work ever since. Again, back to Baseball America back in the day, and now over at MLB.com, which is, I believe, his segment of it, MLBPipeline.com. But that's our program for tonight. Hopefully you enjoyed talking a little bit of prospects. We're going to do more and more prospect talk in the future, hopefully. Again, we post these podcasts over at MinorLeagueBall.com. I'm going to be having Chris Mitchell from Fangraphs. Again, my name is Chris Mitchell, but I write for RotoExperts.com as well as MinorLeagueBall.com. I do some writing for Baseball America as well. But there's another Chris Mitchell, and maybe he's probably known better than me. He came up with the Cato statistical model over at Fangraphs. We had him on the show previously. We're going to have him on in the next couple of weeks. He's updating his top 100 list as we speak. His Cato rankings are he created it. We're going to talk about that. He can explain it like he did the last time. And if you want to listen to our podcast, I do 2-3 podcasts per week. We do a lot of American and National League recaps. We do some general baseball podcasts as well. But if you want to go back over at minorleagueball.com and listen to some of our previous podcasts, I'm not saying that you necessarily want to listen to the American League recap from week 5, but we have Jim Callis on. This is probably the third or fourth time I've had Jim on with me, a couple times for minorleagueball.com. I've had him a couple times before I joined minorleagueball.com. We talked with Jay Jaffe. We've talked with Rob Nyer. We've talked with, like I said, Chris Mitchell from Fangraphs. We talked with Eno Saris from Fangraphs. And a lot of those conversations are not necessarily timely. They're not just week 5 of the baseball season. A lot of those are general pitching conversations and prospect conversations that you can listen to at any time. So if you want to hear some of those podcasts with some of those guests, you can follow me at CJMitch73. You can join our Facebook page where we talk a lot of baseball, and you can get links to all of the podcasts there. I post a rundown as well as the links to the podcast in that Facebook group every single night. So if you want to scroll down the group, you'll find hundreds of podcast links in there. It's a podcast to be named later. Or you can go over to minorleagueball.com. At CJMitch is my handle over at Minor League Ball. And if you look there, you'll find the podcast, and you scroll through and research the website, and you'll find all of those different podcasts. Or you can just ask me. If you want to tweet to me and you want me to give you a podcast, I can get it for you. Because as I said, Rob Nyer, Jay Jaffe, Eno Saris, we've had some pretty good guests on here talking a lot of different types of topics. And, of course, we do two or three podcasts a week, which are timely. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Again, follow me on Twitter, at CJMitch73. Or if you want to talk baseball with us, join our Facebook group, A Podcast to Be Named Later. This has been the Prospect Update. That was Jim Callis. Coming up on Thursday, we're going to be talking American League All-Stars with Brandon C. Williams from RotoExperts.com. So that'll be tomorrow. And if you want my fantasy content, you can head on over to RotoExperts.com. I'm actually writing up sleepers from the 2016 amateur draft. And a trick you can use to identify sleepers without having to read every single scouting report and pick apart the sleepers. I'll give you a quick little hint. Look at the signing bonuses. When you see someone signed for first-round money, but he was drafted in the fifth round, that guy's a potential sleeper. So that's basically the premise. I select some of the players, and I do some write-ups on them, and I'm going to be posting those over at rotoexperts.com. So if you want to read that article, that'll be posted here in the next 24 hours. Thanks, everybody. Be good. I hope we had a great 4th of July weekend. Hopefully you're being good and enjoying your summers, and hopefully you'll tune in with us talking more and more baseball here on A Podcast to Be Named Later.